just coming together, walking down here for George Floyd, just protesting inequalities for African Americans and really everybody across the world, minority-wise, just trying to make change, trying to put into action what we talk about, and just trying to live out what we speak.
That was University of Missouri linebacker Nick Bolton, who, along with 60 of his teammates, marched last week to protest racial injustice following the death of George Floyd. College athletes across the country are speaking up. But that wasn't the case just 5 years ago, when a group of Mizzou football players threatened to boycott a game after a series of racially charged incidents rocked their campus. Today, one of the players who organized that protest joins us to take stock of how much things have changed. Then ESPN's David Hale walks us through the movement that's sweeping the college sports landscape. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Wednesday, June 10th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Marathon. So, Ian, we wanted to talk to you today because in many ways, what is happening across the country at this moment with college athletes mirrors the experience that you and your teammates had back in 2015. But first, I want to ask what it's been like for you right now to see all of these college athletes speaking out over the last couple of weeks after the killing of George Floyd.
It's been really inspiring. It's been really promising.
Ian Simon was a safety at the University of Missouri from 2011 to 2015.
Gives me a lot of hope for the future and the direction that these athletes are taking. I think we're starting to wake up to the platform that we have and the ability to actually impact change and impact people's lives, because whether you like it or not, they're role models. So it's just really promising to see that these kids are starting to understand that and use it for, you know, use it for good.
Let's go back to 2015 when you were in school. Before the protests at Missouri first began, when did you first notice there were issues with race on campus at Mizzou?
When I first got there. I grew up in a small town in the South. Racism was always been a part of my life. But for the first time, I wasn't around people that I knew. I was a stranger to these people. And it was obvious that I wasn't Ian Simon anymore. I was just another black guy. And I was definitely treated as such. A lot of it was just people not giving me the benefit of the doubt until they found out that I played football. When they found out I played football, their whole demeanor changed. And then they were very welcoming and very supportive and very, you know, hey, you know, I can help you out with this, you know, da 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 da. If you need ever need anything, give me a call. That was a huge reality check that, you know, now you're a grown man now. Now you're not the cute little kid that everybody used to think you were. Now you're one of everybody else until they find out that you play football.
So this wasn't just something that you noticed. There was a series of incidents involving race, racism across campus that ultimately led to student protests in October 2015. The student body president reported that he had been called the N-word. There was a swastika smeared on a bathroom wall with feces. And this spurred a series of protests on campus, which were led by a student named Jonathan Butler, who went on a hunger strike demanding action.
Students and faculty are both suspending academic activities today in support of Jonathan Butler, the 25-year-old graduate student and campus activist who is in day number 8 of his hunger strike. Butler says he will not eat again until University System President Tim Wolf either is removed or resigns.
What do you remember about when you first met Jonathan?
I was like shocked. I'd never seen anybody starving before. I remember I'd seen Jonathan before on campus. I'd seen him actually seen a couple of times here and there on campus. And I remember what he looked like then. And then fast forwarding to when I saw him again and just seeing how he looked, like so sickly. You could tell he had lost a bunch of weight. He was super weak. It was so surreal seeing someone willing to do that to themselves and willing to die for their cause. That's something I just never witnessed before in person. You see, you know, see the movies about people doing stuff like that, or, you know, making a grandstand, but, you know, it's not one of those things you ever actually think you're going to run into, especially while you're in college.
So after learning more about these protests and what was happening on campus, what did you and the rest of the football team decide to do?
I want to say it was about 22 to 24 of us. I can't remember the exact number. We were just all kind of sitting around at one of our teammates' houses and we're thinking, what can we do? How can we help? The idea came that we, you know, we boycott the next game against BYU. And so we all just kind of sat in a room and, you know, kind of just raised our hands individually and who said, you know, if we're going to do this, we all need to be unified on it. And we decided that that would be the best course of action. That'd be the most impactful. And that'd be that would get the attention of people the most if we decided to boycott a game. After we came to that decision, we decided that we need to tell Coach Pinkel. And like I said, that was scary. That was a super intimidating moment to have to tell your coach that you're not going to play the next game unless these things happen and what's happening and why you're doing it. And so, and I was the one who made the call to him. So I had to explain it to him. And to his credit, and thank goodness, he listened. Coach Pinkel just sat there and listened. He didn't say a word. And other guys talked too. And like we were crying. Like we were at that point, by that point, we were that moved by everything that we had heard and that passionate about it that we felt like we had to do something and that was going to be the best way to do it. So it was just, you know, kind of no other option. It was a no-brainer after that.
30 African-American football players at the University of Missouri say they're on strike and they won't play again until the university's president, Tim Wolf, resigns or is removed. It is the latest in a series of protests against the school's handling of race relations on campus.
Were you guys aware of the financial ramifications of what you were doing?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That was a big part of it because we understood that to put these games on and all the money that it brings in for the university is huge. Like that was a huge reason as to why we chose to go this route. Cause we felt like when you start affecting people's money, that's when they start to pay attention. And we are the money makers on campus, as in just about every campus across America. Football teams bring in the most money. It's the biggest sport in America. We understood that that gave us a unique advantage and a huge bargaining chip that they couldn't ignore.
You said your coach received your decision well and was listening and understanding. How did the rest of, I was going to say your campus, but really America, right? How did people react to your guys' decision to boycott a game?
Oh, that was not well. A lot of my teammates weren't happy. A lot of former teammates, my teammates weren't happy. And it kind of felt like at that point, kind of like the walls were caving a little bit. There was a lot of negative feedback, a lot of negative pushback, and a lot of, you know, kind of shut up. You guys don't know what you're talking about. You know, you guys aren't politicians. What are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. We felt like we were being attacked from all sides in a sense.
What happened next at Missouri?
Things got really tense on campus after that. There was a report, if I remember, of a truck riding through town or riding through campus with the Confederate flag, looking for black people to harm and stuff like that. I remember that night. That was pretty intense. We went and saw Jonathan, checked in on him again, kept in touch with everybody, but just a lot of waiting until the demands were met. That following Monday morning, President Wolf had resigned.
There's breaking news from Columbia, Missouri right now as the University of Missouri president has resigned. Tim Wolf has in fact resigned.
I take full responsibility for this frustration. And I take full responsibility for the inaction that has occurred.
What happened after he resigned?
We had had another meeting and we kind of all found out together. And so there was a lot of cheering. I know we hugged. And then we had made a promise to Coach Pinkel that the moment that this was all done, it was back to football. We told the coaches, you know, and everything like that. We, you know, we're men of our word. We, you know, it was back to football. And we started preparing for BYU.
Did you feel that the protest worked?
Absolutely. I felt like it started a conversation. I felt like it made people uncomfortable. And that's when change happens. You can't grow if without being uncomfortable. You can't get stronger, you can't get faster, you can't learn. That wasn't a comfortable position to be in. and it wasn't a comfortable position to put other people in, especially people of authority, but they had no choice to deal with it. So I definitely think it was a success.
Well, Ian, as I'm sure you're aware, in response to the death of George Floyd and others, along with, you know, many other college players across the country, over 60 Missouri football players marched from campus to the Boone County Courthouse in Columbia to register to vote. And they were received very differently from how you guys received so many years ago. They're widely praised for their solidarity. What is it like for you watching that and thinking about how far we've come?
It's awesome. I mean, because in the grand scheme of things, it hasn't been that long. And to see how well they were received, that was awesome. Like, that made me super proud to be an alumni of the school. It made me very proud to be a part of that program and be a part of that foundation. That made me feel really good. That kind of warmed my heart, because those are young men who are going to make an impact in the future and continue to set the tone for what it means to be a Missouri football player on the field and off the field. So that was super, super empowering and super heartwarming to see.
Thank you, Ian.
No problem, it's Mina. Thank you.
Coming up, I speak with ESPN college football writer David Hale about how today's players are feeling more empowered than ever to speak out about their experiences with racism. Hi, guys. Given everything that is happening in the world right now, most of us are buying things online. I saw that AT&T started doing two really helpful things for those who want to buy a new phone or device online. They are offering fast, free, non-contact delivery and curbside pickup so that online shopping is as simple and safe as possible. On top of that, they have a flexible return policy so you can shop at ease. You can visit att.com to learn how to shop online from the safety of your home 24/7. Subject to change, restrictions apply. I'm joined now by David Hale, college football writer for ESPN. David, we just heard from Ian Simon, who you spoke to for your story, which was titled, "I Just Can't Be Silent Anymore," about how more players across college sports are speaking up about racial injustice, and not just broadly speaking up, but telling specific stories about things that happened to them at their programs. What do you think has shifted from when Ian and his teammates first spoke up to now?
There's a lot, I think, that plays a role, but one sort of commonality here is there's strength in numbers. And the Missouri team in 2015, there was a campus-wide protest that the players were a part of, and they had upwards of about two dozen guys that were actively involved in this protest, willing to say, "I will sit out games if need be." And there's strength in that. When one guy has to be the one taking the brunt of the blowback, I think it's a lot tougher. But more than that, we're at a social moment. You know, sports is a microcosm of society in so many ways. And we are at a moment in society where people are speaking out all over the place. Mm-hmm. And not just speaking out again, and as you said, in sort of general terms, but sharing the specific stories. And I think that's what's so impactful, is it's not just, hey, racism is bad and there are power dynamic problems on college campuses, which I think the average person would tend to know. It's when you get put into their shoes and can kind of feel the burden that they've been carrying, and that's the stories that they've been telling. I think it is such a bigger change and a bigger step forward in that sense.
You've been covering college sports for years. Were players telling these stories at all in the past, or were you hearing whispers of them?
You know, I mean, you'd always hear a little bit of things. I mean, you would hear about this coach doesn't like recruiting black guys from the inner cities, or you would hear like, oh, this coach won't let us wear hoodies or won't let us play hip hop music in the locker room. And I mean, those stories would come up, how verifiable they all were, or whether it was just, you know, an angry player about something. It was hard to say enough that, certainly not enough that I would have felt comfortable sitting down and writing a story about any one of those allegations at any point. But what you would hear would be sort of the secondhand versions. And the reasons that you would hear that is because the access to direct conversations with players is so minimal for us in the media, and really, you know, for the average fans, for almost anybody. Because if I want to talk to a college football player, for the most part, I got to schedule that interview through the sports information department. It gets signed off by the head coach. Then we sit down with someone from their PR department looking over the shoulder, listening to every word that he says. So they're not inclined to speak up. And that's the story I've heard over and over and over again in talking to these guys, is that the pressure on them not to speak up about problems, both in terms from an athletics department standpoint, but just from a don't rock the boat within the locker room standpoint, was immense.
Well, that cuts to a point you made in your story, which is a lot of these stories have surfaced through social media, through athletes, you know, actually using their own platforms to share these accounts of things that have happened to them. How important do you think social media has been in all of this, in bringing these issues to light?
It's absolutely critical, because you look at just the situation at Iowa as a perfect example of this. Essentially, one tweet came out saying, hey, there is a real culture issue around race within the football program at Iowa. And the responses to that one tweet, almost a dozen current former Iowa players tweeting their own experiences, the rules about the culture there that disallowed everything from hoodies to earrings to exposed tattoos or the type of music that you'd listen to. And with the strength and conditioning coach there, who would use very racially charged language, Kirk Ferentz, the head coach there, has issued a statement in which he said that he was glad that the players brought it to his attention. He held a media press conference as well and said that they are investigating it. The strength and conditioning coach, who has denied these allegations, has been put on paid leave. The thing about some of these stories is I don't know that any of them, if you just heard them on their own, just one person say, this is this one thing that happened to me, you might say, well, that's, you know, that's the way they run things at Iowa, or, oh, that was your one experience. But the conglomeration of all of those tweets that came out in response to that first one lent it a lot of power and credence that, like, this isn't a one-off, this is a real cultural issue there.
The other thing I found shocking about the Iowa story was something I didn't know, which is apparently they had a social media policy in place where players could not tweet freely. They had to have their language pre-approved. How does that strike you?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a very problematic situation in a lot of respects, because I think what we're seeing, I think, right now, both nationally and the greater social sphere and within college football, is sort of this conglomeration of events that's happening. And within football, it's you know, the pandemic, and we're all sort of looking at the money that schools are making and talking about that now. And with the rules about name, image, likeness that's being debated, we're all sort of talking about the rights that these athletes have. They have strictly been quantified as student athletes and not employees. And when you start talking about, well, what kind of rights do you have as an athletics department to restrict the First Amendment rights of a non-employee, I mean, boy, these are just rabbit holes that you can go down one after the other after the other. And so it's not really a surprise that this stuff is coming out now. I think a lot of players were really fed up with it to begin with.
The other school that's in the news is Clemson, where head coach Dabo Swinney released on Monday a video statement in which he defended his assistant coach, Danny Pierman, who was accused of using a racial slur in practice 3 years ago.
Forgiveness and grace, I think, is important. It's important for any of us. But I've known Danny Pierman for 30 years. And Danny Pierman is a good man. He's had incredible relationships with his players. You can call Dwayne Allen. You can call Jordan Leggett. You can call Brandon Ford and on and on and on. He's had great relationships with his players. This was totally out of character, but we dealt with it and we moved on.
Dabo defended himself really on many things. David, how did that strike you?
Yeah, and his most recent statement, a 14-minute pre-recorded statement that was released on Clemson's website, was, if I was to use one adjective to describe it, defensive would be the adjective that I used. I mean, he said Clemson has been under attack as a program, and here he went through point by point some of the concerns, ranging from Danny Pierman using the N-word during practice, and he was not fired for it. Another player suggested that Dabo may have used the N-word in correcting players or telling players not to play hip-hop music that included that word. Dabo, for his part, has vehemently denied it, as have other players who were in the room, said that that was not true. Additionally, Dabo was a picture got out and kind of went viral over the weekend, you know, with Black Lives Matter being at the forefront of the conversation right now. Dabo took a picture with some fans at the pool at his country club wearing a t-shirt that said "Football Matters." It was certainly an error in judgment. I do not believe it was a malicious one. Dabo has said it was not a malicious one. But part of the problem here is that Dabo really hasn't said much of anything. When asked what his role in these conversations and this changing landscape that we're in right now as a country, Dabo has essentially said, look, I'm a football coach. And actually, he said that a number of times in his statement. I'm just a football coach. We're just a football program. But, you know, I think people have asked for more from him. I mean, he is the highest paid public employee in the state of South Carolina, a state that has had myriad racial issues there and flew the Confederate flag at the state capitol until a couple of years ago. So I think there is a genuine desire from a lot of people to see Dabo take a larger piece of the platform that he has to speak out, and particularly with all of these other stories that have sort of surrounded the program over the last week and a half or so, to maybe be a little less defensive and a little more vocal in understanding what the problem is.
Another ACC school where the coach recently apologized was Florida State, where head coach Mike Norvell, well, he said he had originally reached out individually to each of his players to address concerns they had after the death of George Floyd. Then the players compared notes and said, yeah, that didn't happen. Norvell later backtracked. He said he was wrong to have said that.
The FSU situation is interesting for a couple of reasons. One being that Mike Norvell's a new coach there. Spring largely gets canceled. There was not this firm belief and trust that players and coaching staff had. They just hadn't been together long enough to develop that. So that was part of it. But the other thing that's so, I think, important about what happened there is that it was Marvin Wilson who did it. And Marvin Wilson is going to be a first-round draft pick. He is a legitimate star. And so much of this is, you know, again, you talk about what the pressure that is on these guys not to rock the boat. And a big part of that is, do you lose playing time? Do you lose future money? Mm-hmm. You know, it's easier for the third string kicker to speak out because he really doesn't have a whole lot to lose. And so, I've seen with the Clemson situation, the fans that respond, oh, he was just a walk-on. I don't care what he has to say. Like, that's a problem. But the reason that it's walk-ons and transfers that speak out is because they have the freedom to do it. That Marvin Wilson would speak out, I think, is one of those things that really does change the dynamic, because that guy does have something to lose. It won't surprise me at all if during the draft process next year, there's some NFL exec who says, I don't want to draft this guy because he's, you know, he's a problem. He's a troublemaker. But that's the risk he was willing to take in speaking out.
David, as college athletes find their voices, and just as importantly, find them together, as you've described, do you think there's the potential for broader change beyond this? I mean, in the past, players have tried to unionize unsuccessfully. Obviously, the issue of player pay hangs over all of this. Do you think there's a potential that we could see this sort of activism lead to broader structural change?
I think that is the big question here. As you said, I've been covering college sports for a long time. I'm a little jaded and cynical about these things, and I have my doubts that the entire sort of underpinnings of how college football work are going to be turned on their head. I started writing this or thinking about this story in terms of bringing players back onto campus during a pandemic, and why don't they have more say in it? And I had players say, like, I don't have a choice. I've got to go back, and it might end up risking my family and people that I care about because of it, but I don't have a choice. These are conversations beyond the social moment that we're in right now with the protests and these conversations about social justice and policing and race. There's tons of these types of debates that surround college athletes, and we don't have their voice as a part of the conversation. So I do hope that we are at a point in time in which that's going to change. I don't want to be necessarily the guy who is so cynical about all of this, but it's super easy to endorse your players speaking out today in June when it's a game coming up that week in October. Things might be a little different.
Thanks so much, David.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how one NBA player is bucking convention. We're presented by Marathon. Now more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we're aware travel may not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop into the car to run an errand. Or maybe you just want to drive to see your best friend, simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. And right now, you can get 5 cents off every gallon every day with Make It Count rewards from Marathon. Plus, you can earn points for additional savings on fuel, airfare, hotels, and more. This is definitely a deal you can count on. It's also quick and easy to join. Just download the free Make It Count app or go to makeitcount.com/radio and start saving today. This offer is valid only at participating Marathon stations. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit. Here's another story I want you to know. So this one is not particularly serious, but it is quite delightful. ESPN's Malika Andrews wrote a great story about an NBA player whose time away from the court has been more unusual than most. Turns out George Hill of the Milwaukee Bucks has been living on a ranch with his family and a menagerie of exotic animals, including kangaroos, zebras, and more. So I asked Malika to tell us a bit more about Hill's collection. Malika, how did you first learn about George Hill and his various animals?
You know, around the Bucks locker room, it really isn't a secret that George Hill is a country boy, if you will. So it was definitely something that the guys talked about. But I remember I read a line in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that just mentioned that George owned a few funky, different exotic animals. And I went to him and I said, okay, what's going on here? He was talking about it during the playoffs last season when he started saying, man, you know, I'm really excited for in the off season when I get to go to my ranch. And as someone who, you know, I grew up riding horses, I thought, oh, cool. What kinds of thoroughbreds or cows or pigs might you have on your ranch? And he said, oh, no, I have wildebeests and zebras. And that just, wait, what? I mean, excuse me, can you tell me a little bit more about this? And so that's sort of how it first came up.
So where is George's ranch?
His ranch is in Texas Hill Country, which he assured me that's not the reason, the name resemblance was not the reason that he chose to purchase the 850-acre ranch that he bought. So Texas Hill Country is about 35 minutes north of San Antonio, and George and his wife Samantha have a home in San Antonio. He played his rookie year with the Spurs, and he told me that he always knew that he wanted to invest in land.
Was he always interested in starting a place like this with this array of animals?
No. It all started with a horse named Ropey that he had when he was a teenager. And he was growing up in Indianapolis, which isn't stereotypically necessarily horse country. I mean, Indianapolis is the capital city. But the way he sort of described it to me is that pockets of Indianapolis, it goes from farmland to downtown to what he described as the quote-unquote hood very quickly. And sometimes those things are not mutually exclusive. So he didn't grow up in the best part of town. He went to a high school that had, you know, some violence that surrounded it. But George Hill still in this neighborhood that maybe isn't what you would, an outsider would look at and see as property where horses were owned, had a horse. And he would go and get his horse, and he would saddle up his horse, and he would ride his horse down the street, and he would tie it to a tree while he would go play pickup basketball. And so that was sort of exotic in its own right in that way. But as he grew older, that sort of taste for wanting exotic animals grew and grew into an even bigger kind of obsession, I guess, that he had. And then that ended up translating into mostly African safari animals. And then obviously the kangaroo, too.
So you mentioned kangaroos, zebras, and wildebeest, which I did not know existed until about 30 seconds ago. What other kinds of animals does he have?
Oh, man. He has fallow deer. He has 50 bazillion different types of deer. He has fallow deer. He has sables. He has scimitar orcs, which is a kind of antelope. He has kudu, ostrich, New Zealand red stag. He told me he could keep going. When I said, wait, I need you to slow down as I list all of these things. So he keeps a whole bunch of animals on his land.
I'm going to ask a question, and I'm worried that you already answered it because maybe there's another name for it, but I'm going to ask anyways.
No, ask it. Go ahead.
Okay, you mentioned George has antelopes, and I fear that they might be the same thing, but does he have any bucks?
I saw a couple of people comment, he needs to have a buck. He didn't explicitly tell me that he has bucks. My understanding is a buck is a male deer, but...
I think that's right. Yeah, the logo does have antlers.
Yes, the logo has antlers. He showed me some pictures of things that resembled the Bucks logo. Let's go with that.
Terrific. Well, this is ESPN Daily, not Animal Daily, so I will not apologize for our lack of knowledge on that front. Thank you so much, Malika. This was fun.
I appreciate it, Mina.
I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.